Good evening, welcome to the penultimate media agenda talk. Next week we've got something a bit different really. I've been trying to get a really good photojournalist to come along and talk much more about kind of imagery and pictures and how they can be used, how you can use that to have an impact on a big issue in a kind of political way. So Mark Neville next week is going to be really interesting, I can assure you. Today, though, I'm really pleased. I'm going to hand over in a second to Rafał, who you may know from, some of you may have been taught by him, one of our postdoc students here in the department. I'm really pleased, as a journalist, that we've got our first proper journalist talking about journalism today, somebody who, in baby face still, has achieved more in his career so far than people often achieve in a lifetime. He's been everywhere, done lots of stuff, but most importantly, he's thought about it. So I'm going to hand over to Rafał now to kick us off.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Sadly, I'm not a student anymore, but some things I wish I still were. Let me welcome all of you as well in Media Agenda Talks. Today, we are lucky and privileged to welcome Mr. Alex Perry, an awarded journalist, an editor at Newsweek, a correspondent and author. Alex is part of his homepage, lived and worked for 15 years in Asia and Africa, reporting for more than 100 countries and covering more than 30 wars. Alex's newest book, The Rift, The Future of Africa, just came out. Is that right?
Buy it.
Yes, good for bookstores, obviously, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit, as well as his previous books.
They're not as good.
No. Maybe there's a bundle. as well as his numerous e-books, but today Alex will talk to us about challenging the Western narrative of Africa and the importance of storytelling. And our students will especially find this with relevance and connection to the theories lecture this week, which was post-colonial theory. Especially, I think this will relate to ideas of representation, othering, power, which we discussed. And I'm looking forward to everyone's comments and questions to Alex after this talk. But for now, please join me in welcoming Alex Perry. Alex, the floor is yours.
Thank you.
So, hi everyone. I want to talk to you about stories, the importance of stories, narrative, and the dominance of perception over reality. I'm going to begin with a few pictures. This is Somalia, 2011, end of July, early August 2011. Even if you've never been, and most of you won't, that will look reasonably familiar, right? It's conflict, it's war. Mogadishu is the center of the most epic destruction that I've ever seen. But somehow I'm sure that will resonate. You've seen that in movies, you've seen that kind of destruction before. You've seen this before. Heavily armed man, bandanas of bullets, destroyed town. He looks like a bad boy, right? I'm showing you this because, okay, here, bleak destruction, looking out at beauty, but look what has man has done to the land. Beautiful, tragic African Madonna figure with unfortunate urchin. Refugees, again, unfortunate child in a portrait, a frame of destruction. This is a kid that Dominic, who took all these pictures, and I, we were in the room when he died. And so this is his body being prepared for burial.
So this is famine, death, refugees, tragedy, destruction, bad black African men, and hopelessness. And I'm sure that story feels pretty familiar. So, and I can even give you some descriptions to back that up. The famine of Somalia in 2011 was the worst I'd ever seen, and by then I'd seen 20, 25 wars. But the dying was something else. Even at the height of the civil war in Somalia, no one had seen dying like this. Dominic and I, the photographer, we spent a lot of time in a hospital which had a children's ward. And it was small, it only had 7 beds. And we couldn't really understand that, because we knew that hundreds, if not thousands, of people were dying every day, first of all from hunger, but by the time we got there, measles and malaria were sweeping the camps, and thousands were dying every day. And yet, the children's ward in the only hospital in town had 7 beds. But we'd been in there for 20 minutes when we realised that all the kids around us had died. It was difficult to deal with. We saw mothers go back to areas where they buried their kids to find they couldn't find a grave because a refugee camp had appeared over the spot in the night. And you may remember this because in 2011 this hit the headlines. This was front page on most papers. It was on billboards across London, generally as part of an aid campaign. And the message was, East Africa is in crisis, Somalia is in famine, and you need to send us money, us being the aid agencies, because we will fix this. This story, is totally false. That's a story of, I mean, what you get from those pictures, and the story you got from the aid agencies was a story of African helplessness and Western generosity, right? We will come in and fix this problem. It is dire, it is appalling. We are these people's only hope. The true story of the Somali famine is that it was deliberately caused. It took no investigation for me to find this out. I had it sourced from the Somali Prime Minister, the Somali Defence Minister, the Minister of Presidential Affairs, several NGO workers. What happened in Somalia in 2011 was that there was a drought across East Africa. The aid community had known this was coming for a year and had prepared, had stockpiled thousands of tons of food aid across the region. And when the drought that turned to hunger and potentially famine, as everybody knew it would, that food aid started to be released in northern Kenya, in Uganda, in Ethiopia, South Sudan, Djibouti, everywhere except a small pocket in southern Somalia. Why was there no food aid in southern Somalia? Because the US, which was pursuing Al-Shabaab, which is a small Islamist group in southern Somalia, and the US had been prosecuting a war against Al-Shabaab for several years, assassinating its leaders with drones and occasionally helicopter airstrikes and cruise missile strikes and so on, had decided that it wasn't getting enough traction. Al-Shabaab still had the momentum in Somalia. So the US went to the aid agencies and said, here's the thing, Shabaab steals food aid. We know that. So you can make the argument that food aid is a form of support for a prescribed terrorist group. That's a very serious offence under US law. So we would like it if you, the aid agencies, didn't provide any more food aid to that area. The aid agencies objected. In fact, the head of the UN at the time said, gave a sort of quite out of character speech for a UN head of agency, saying that the US was politicising food aid. What he meant was the US was proposing to use food aid to starve out a small guerrilla group in southern Somalia. The US came back to the aid agencies and said, "We are your biggest donor," and from what I understand, all the aid agencies capitulated. So this actually is the story of a famine deliberately caused by the US as part of the war on terror, with the complicity of famine relief workers. Famine relief workers helped cause a famine, and 250,000 people died. What's really interesting about this story, to me, and as regards narratives and perceptions, is that I wrote that story in Time magazine, the biggest English language magazine on the planet, over 10 pages, with Dominic's, you know, reasonably startling photographs, and nobody noticed. Nobody paid any attention. We were expecting a storm. We were expecting the State Department to deny. We were expecting all the aid agencies to object. Nobody noticed. I've since repeated that story. It's the front of my marvellous new book. And I mention it in every single op-ed that I've written about the book, which has been in the Daily Telegraph, it's 4,000 words in Prospect magazine, I've written for the Radio Times, I've even done a piece for the National Children's Newspaper. Nobody has noticed. So what are the conclusions to draw from this? One, perceptions are way more powerful than reality. You can tell people the truth, and they do not hear it. If you are... The perception that we have is made by the same aid agencies that were responsible for one of the worst war crimes since World War II. And they will tell you that Africa is helpless. They are... Since Biafra in 1967, they have given one image for Africa, which is a starving baby. And we are so used to that image. It so defines how we think of Africa. And think about that. Africans don't define Africa. Foreign correspondents don't define Africa. Aid agencies with a single picture define Africa. And we are so conditioned to that, that even when confronted with the facts, we will go back to a misperception. The second slightly, well, for me as a journalist, distressing reality is, even beyond facts not being enough, is that I think it matters more who you are when you're telling a story than what you'll say. I am white, privileged, Oxford educated. I was born in the States. I'm British. I'm basically at the pinnacle of white privilege. My voice doesn't count when I'm talking about Africa. And if my voice is coupled with Time magazine, which it was then, it turns out nobody reads Time magazine to find out about Africa, and nobody interested in Africa reads Time magazine. So you can have 10 pages in the world's biggest magazine, and it doesn't matter. Or a book, actually. Sorry, I've slightly lost my place here, because I've got really... It's years of shorthand. It makes your writing illegible. I guess what I want to come to is the importance of storytelling. I used to think when I started out in local newspapers in the UK, I used to think storytelling was kind of trivial. You know, I never really understood how people would get so upset about stuff that we wrote. You know, it wasn't that we were getting it wrong or getting the facts wrong, but, you know, there was something in the nuance, people didn't feel captured by it, and if you're working on a local newspaper, they get to confront you. They come to the offices, they jump over the counter, and, you know, they punch you. And I never really understood it, because I never really understood why people would take it so seriously. Then I began writing longer stories, and I began learning about structure and narrative and how old stories are, and how we all tell stories. In fact, how fundamental storytelling is. It's how we communicate. It's how we make sense of the world. It's how we define ourselves. Well, the thing is, Africa is changing. It's reclaiming its freedom. And a big part of that is reclaiming the right to tell its own story. From aid agencies, yeah, and from people like me, who, after all, are a kind of colonial anachronism. We're a hangover. Why would you rely on a foreigner to tell you about Africa? Why not us in Africa? How do we know that these are not our stories? Because we get them wrong. That's about all I've got to say. but I encourage you to ask questions. I'm much better at Q&A.
Thank you very much, Alex. Okay, let's open it up to everyone. Any questions?
I just have a quick question about your experience what your research in Boko Haram, and like, just can you tell us a bit about it, and how you were involved with it, and what kind of research you did?
Sure. So Boko is it's a difficult story to report. Essentially, you've got the same problem as Syria. Like, if you go in and you meet them, you know, there's a pretty swift security issue that will confront you. You can try and communicate with Boko through intermediaries, but if you actually try and get an interview, you know, the assumption is that you're going to end up on TV in an orange jumpsuit. So it's a difficult one, and that's very frustrating. You know, if you're a journalist and you're trying to speak to all sides, but what the Boko story, a lot of it misses, is the context in which it's set, and that is, and that goes all the way back to colonialism and how Britain amalgamated two colonies into one, made the northern elite dominant over the south, set up decades of competition between north and south. You know, go through to the present day and 50 years of world record-breaking kleptomania by a government, and you have parts of the north that have genuine grievance against the Nigerian government, who, I mean, the corruption of Nigeria is extraordinary. I mean, $400 billion have been stolen from Nigeria. That's, you know, in the last 50 years. That's more than all the foreign aid that went the other way to Africa. It's, you know, it's insane. And while everybody in Nigeria has lost out in that, the north has lost the most. All that's to say that, so Boko has a bedrock of popular grievance on which to rest itself. Having said that, you know, Boko are not the smartest, most intellectual, most rigorous guerrilla group you'll ever come across. If you're looking for logic and ideology, you're going to come up wanting. They believe more or less every conspiracy going. You know, Yusuf, who was their leader until he was killed in I think 2009, used to deny the evaporation of water, didn't believe the world was round, you know, that kind of stuff. And from what I understand, you know, Boko is even in jihadi circles an embarrassment. You know, they try to affiliate to Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda wouldn't have them. You know, then they put out a sort of feeler to ISIS, and, you know, and lo and behold, the people who like beheading, you know, Westerners on TV said yes. But even that took some time. You know, they are not smart. That, by the way, doesn't make them any less dangerous. In fact, it probably makes them more dangerous. What they do very definitely believe in is killing. And if you see any of the Boko Haram videos that circulate in northern Nigeria, the killing has become the point. It's very ritualized. You'll see sort of 50 Boko Haram fighters gathered in a circle in a sort of ritual manner. There's a ceremony where the main guerrilla leader will read from an ancient text, and then whichever unfortunate soldiers and policemen they've captured will be beheaded with a sword. You know, it's killing is, yeah, as I say, the point. All that sets up horrible challenges for a journalist to cover it, but you get to pierce that if you can't talk to them directly through social media and through these CDs that circulate in the market. They do their own media. And in some ways that's incredibly useful. I did some work on the British kids going out to Syria to fight as well, and those were very, very hard to get in contact with and to interview. They were very, very suspicious of anyone who wasn't in their immediate circle, and it took me a few weeks before I realised that in a sense you didn't need to interview them, because they were Instagramming and Facebooking and blogging everything they did, all their innermost thoughts. And in some ways that was probably even a more honest representation of their thoughts and feelings and aims than an interview would gather. So, you know, it can be done, but there's always a lurking suspicion with something like Boko, and particularly with Syria now, that there is a big black hole of no knowledge that we're not getting to.
Hi. You spoke about the image of Africa, which you said had been defined by the aid agencies over the last few decades as an image of a starving child. And as a foreign correspondent, you find it very, very difficult to kind of talk against that, and I would listen, and I'm bringing in number two brother voices too. Why and how did this image become so powerful?
Well, it starts... I mean, it's actually good publicity, right? It started in Biafra in 1967, which in many ways was kind of the first modern aid campaign. And it's kind of a fascinating story. There was the Biafran rebels employed a PR agency based in Geneva, run by an American guy, to do their PR, to drum up Western support. The Biafran rebels were fighting the Nigerian government. It was a sort of separatist conflict. And the American guy who was running this said, well, you know, nobody cares about Biafra. You know, how do we get attention? How do we get them on side? Well, you do that by telling your audience that they can be remarkably proactive in this story. You make the audience the subject of the story. And you see that today, like in any aid campaign around there now, it's the message is you, the audience, the reader, the attendant of a pop concert in Central Park, you can fix the world. You can. Often, apparently, just by being aware. But the point is to make you the subject. And what this does, obviously, is make the African, who should be the subject of this story, the object. And so you become the subject. It's about your generosity. You know, there's something wrong with our idea of charity that you know, this has happened. And as I say, this is done for reasons of of relevance, of making this kind of stuff relevant. How do you make it relevant? You position the donor as the vital, crucial person in this story. But that makes the African or the poor Southeast Asian irrelevant. You know, they are no longer the actors in their own story. You are their saviour. And that repositioning, recalibrating, essentially in perceptions, not in reality, is incredibly successful. It was incredibly successful in Biafra, and it continues to this day. You know, you'll see it from any, as I say, any aid campaign, but the most notorious example recently is Invisible Children. I don't know if anybody remembers that. They were the guys that were three college kids, essentially, in the States who created a campaign to hunt down the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. And essentially, I mean, three college kids got Obama to invade, you know. And how did they do that? They did it by saying, we in the West, American students, can make the difference and can save these people from themselves. And trying to counter that as a journalist is hard. You know, the story of Africa's economic rise, which me and the other 100 correspondents in Africa have been covering for 10 to 15 years, is frankly the more interesting story. But we're completely outnumbered. There's 100 of us. There's thousands, if not 10,000, press officers in Africa putting out the story that Africa is helpless and needs to be saved. And we have the more interesting story, as I say, but they have the far louder one. I don't get to book a billboard in Suffolk, you know, and tell you to care, you know. But the aid agencies will, and you'll see it now. You'll see it in the run-up to Christmas. This is peak giving time. And on the back of every newspaper or every magazine, you'll have a picture of the starving baby with a tagline that basically emotionally blackmails you. And sort of says, if you don't give... I mean, these absurd figures. If you give $3, this child will live. Implication being, if you don't give $3, this child will die. You know. I mean, we could go on. I do go on about the dishonesty of that and how, you know, the industry of aid in Africa is itself a... One of its greatest tricks is selling a perception of itself. Aid is $55.8 billion in Africa. It's the biggest business in Africa. It's the same as the GDP as 20 African countries. It's massive. It employs 600,000 people. That's more than US oil and gas, the biggest industry on the planet. This is business. And this business depends on image. And the image is helpless people needing to be saved by aid workers. I'm not saying aid workers are nasty people. They're actually, a lot of them are my friends, and they're very well-intentioned. Nor am I saying that they're ignorant to these paradoxes and dilemmas. This is a very live debate within the aid community, just that they don't have it in public.
Winnie?
So I guess it's a follow-up question to that. What do you think of that? I mean, you said that Africa is reclaiming its freedom and the right to tell its own story. So, what are the actual ways in which that's happening? Do the Western media actually care about having African reporters telling their African story?
Right. I mean, yeah. How do we counter it? Well, probably we don't. Probably it's not up to us, because what's really interesting to me about Africa's economic rise, and that, you know, I mean, very briefly, Africa has been growing very fast since the millennium. In the last decade, you take any year, 5 of the fastest 10 countries at least in the world have been African. You know, it's the average African is now $200 richer than the average Indian. You know, who knew? But those are the facts. You know, we see India as this coming economic giant, and we still like to see Africa as a basket case. We don't probably change these perceptions. I mean, I wrote a book, but the first line of the book says, this isn't really my story to tell. You know, there's a real legitimacy problem here.
with me telling the story. And in fact, I searched for 2 years to find an African who I could tell the whole story of Africa through and failed, because simply Africa is too large. It's 49 countries. There was nobody who'd been all the places that I'd been, merely because it was my job. But the mood in Africa now is furious assertion. And what really ticks off a tech entrepreneur in Kenya or Uganda, or the man in Congo-Brazzaville who's invented a tablet, or the other man in Congo-Brazzaville who's sending rockets into the stratosphere, is to be summarized as a starving baby. That's literally the infantilizing of an entire continent, a billion people in 49 countries. And what economic growth does is give Africans the means and the authority to reclaim their freedom and reclaim their story and that fundamental human right, the ability to define yourself. And you see it more and more. I mean, the human rights community hate this guy, but Paul Kagame in Rwanda is remarkable in terms of his refusal to let anybody else define him or tell his own story. The human rights community will tell you he's a baby-eating African dictator. It's true that Paul Kagame is no Democrat, but actually the story of Rwanda for the last 20 years is the rebound from a genocide to a country that is now ninth on the list of ease of doing business in the world. You know, that's pretty remarkable. From a genocide? From a Holocaust? And you get more, I mean, the latest guy is the new president of Tanzania. You know, extraordinary man who walks into hospitals and when the hospital's not functioning correctly, fires the manager of the hospital. And has banned ministers from taking, you know, unnecessary foreign travel, who travels by public transport himself. You know, it's that kind of leadership that is redefining perceptions of Africa, not just to the outside world, but to Africans themselves, actually. So, you know, in a sense, it's not, while misperceptions of Africa, you know, frustrate me, and it's why I wrote that book. It's as I say right at the beginning, it's not really my job to correct them, and increasingly Africans will correct them themselves.
Can I push you a little bit on that?
Sure.
Alex, if I can. So, just to get you talking a little bit about legitimacy and voice, because you do problematize legitimacy, and you talked about yourself being educated, white male, but you also make a very strong case of support, how we're getting Africa wrong and how we might get it right. And you say that you make a case because, well, you researched it, you have the facts, and you have sort of a body of work to back it up, but surely... And not each narrative will be as clear-cut and perhaps be more problematic, especially if we take into account the post-colonial times and the voice representation. So could you talk a bit about that and the challenges for journalists and for researchers as well?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, my position, the argument I make in the book, and it's essentially what I believe, is that Europeans have always got Africa wrong. I mean, got it wrong from the moment they first arrived there. And that had a lot to do with their motivations. When Europeans first went to Africa, the very first European to go to Africa was a man called Jaime Ferrer, who was a Majorcan sailor in 1347. Why did he go? Because he heard there was a really, really rich man in Africa and he wanted to rip him off. That was why he went. And it's true, there was. The richest man who has ever lived was the Malian emperor of the time, who built Timbuktu. Okay, so we went out of mercantile acquisition. We didn't see civilization when we got there. Even when it was there, Ethiopia had been more civilized, more cosmopolitan, more Christian than Europe for hundreds of years. Before, you know, when Europe was scrambling around in the Dark Ages, Ethiopia had diplomatic relations with Venice and the Middle East, and it's got a pottery style in common with ancient Greece. It had relations with Palestine when Solomon was on the throne. You know, and yet when we arrived, we didn't recognize civilization. It wasn't as though civilization didn't exist. It's that we didn't recognize it when it was there. When Europeans first got to Zimbabwe and found the ruins of Great Zimbabwe, this giant stone conical structure in the center of the country, the immediate assumption was that the Romans had been to Africa, or maybe the Phoenicians, or maybe the Chinese. But nobody thought it was the locals. And so we have laboured. I mean, I think there's an absolutely straight line from that will for ignorance to today. And it's written forever in stone. I mean, we had no interest in Africa. Most of the time, Africa was just an obstacle to overcome on the way to Asia and to tap the spice trade. And you can see it in the names of African countries, like the Portuguese, who were the first to round Africa. They got to Cap Verde. What do they call it? You know, Green Cape. Well, you know, it's not that imaginative. It got worse. When they went to Cameroon, they called Cameroon after the Portuguese word for prawn, because there were lots of prawns in the sea. When they got to Mozambique, they named a 2,000-kilometre stretch of coastline after a man called Musa al-Beek, who they met there. This is not conquest or exploration of a curious kind. This is precisely the opposite. You know, if you read the diaries of the early explorers, all they talk about is currents and weather patterns and rocks. When they meet Africans, they talk about them as sources of information, generally to be tortured to extract that information. But that's about it. They don't see people. They don't see civilization. They just see an earlier form of primitive man. And I think that essentially continues to this day. And one of the reasons I feel that is because in Africa themselves, Africans absolutely make that connection. Absolutely make that connection. If you look at the NGOs, particularly the UN system, you know, and the clusters of NGOs in places like Goma or Nairobi or recently Mali, and you'll find NGO workers living as essentially the 1% of Africa, going to the finest restaurants and you know, on ludicrous salaries, then you will find Africans looking at that and seeing exactly the same kind of imperial arrogance that they perceived under colonial times, only now it comes in a white SUV. There is no difference in perception, and that, to me, you know, that perception is really almost all you need to know.
Sorry, we've been waiting here for a while. Go ahead, yeah.
Yes.
So I just have a question for you. You're talking about telling stories and not othering, as well as charities, and we know they're not excluding politics. Sometimes they're even correct with politics, as you demonstrated. Not everybody can physically travel to these areas to help out or to get the authentic stories. So during times of crisis, what can we do, and is awareness enough, or can we do anything really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, awareness. I mean, I guess, you know, intuitively it's a good thing to be aware. But I have a problem with it when it seems to stop there, you know. What was the recent concert around the UN General Assembly in Central Park? That was an awareness-generating event. You know, really? And the logic seemed to be, if us, whatever, 50,000 people in this crowd are aware, we will end poverty somehow through power of thought. I mean, again, you know, I mean, Invisible Children were the most remarkable sort of recent exponent of this, who seemed to suggest that you could fix the world through introspection. If you concentrated on the purity of your spirit and intentions, this would, by osmosis, or I don't know, ESP, you know, fix the planet. You know, if you think about it, it's just, you know, it's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. What can you do? Well, being aware is a start, but be aware of the real facts. You know, be aware of the fact that, for instance, development is not something that is handed out off the back of a plane. You know, it's not airdropped. Development is an internal thing. It's about imagination and ambition and determination and striving. it's not something, you know, you can deliver out of the back of an SUV. So you can perhaps help create a context and an environment for that sort of stuff. You can help with education, you can help with health, you can build roads, you can Africa's biggest challenge has always been infrastructure, simply because it's so large. You know, it's actually very difficult to join up a place that big. So you can help with that sort of stuff, but it's merely setting the context. It is not about leading development. You know, that's about entrepreneurism. That's about, as I say, a sort of much more internal dynamic. But you won't hear that from the development agencies, who will position themselves as the developers of Africa. It's in the language, you know. I mean, what's that slogan? Make poverty history. Really? You're going to do that, sitting in London, thinking good thoughts, going to a concert, and putting a fiver in a donor bucket. I mean, really? Make poverty history. You're going to do that to someone else, thousands of miles away. I mean, when you think about it, it's nonsensical. I'm not saying, you know, don't care, don't be aware. I'm saying, draw back a bit from this misperception, this, you know, the mistaken narrative, really. But if people, you know, people often ask me, you know, what can we do to help? Well, the aid initiatives that I like, there are certain agencies that are great. I will say MSF, they're marvellous. They fly economy, they don't drive SUVs. They are, you know, and they are out there and generally the first in a crisis, way months before the UN. Or look at a smaller project, you know, where you can directly see the results. You know, if you're interested in education, we'll help someone build a school. But the main impulse, or the foundation of any effort you're going to make, has to be ask people what they want. Don't tell them they've got to celebrate their diverse sexuality, or they've, you know, oh, what you really need to do is be sort of ecologically sound with your energy. I mean, ask people what their priorities are, you know. And that patronizing paternalism, you see it today. Obama went to Kenya recently and said, we love your vibrancy, and we love, you know, the fact that your economy is taking off, but you're terrible with gays, and you've got a corruption problem, and, you know, we really, you know, wish you'd take more care of the forest, or something like that. Well, imagine the Kenyan president going to America and saying, we love your vibrancy, and we love your energy, but you've got a real gun control problem. I mean, it's insane, right? But that's the equivalent. You know, and so equivalence, actually, is something that Africa is demanding now. And if you're looking for an initiative to help Africa, that, I think, has to be a watchword. Look for an initiative that will treat Africans as equals.
Some countries in Africa have managed to shift away from the perception of their basket case of sustainable development, so Nigeria, South Africa, two examples. They do have probably better economic growth than the other examples you've given, but what do you think is driving that, those countries moving away from this perception that they need help, they need assistance from the West?
Well, it's essentially it's business, you know, and a very pre-seed version. Why did Africa take longer to develop than the rest of the world? Because it's huge, and because it historically didn't have many people. The population of Africa stayed at about 40 to 50 million until about 100 years ago. Why? Because it had a horrendous disease burden, it had big animals that would eat people, and industrial slavery. So the population never grew. What happens if the people are incredibly spread in a giant place? You get no cities. What are cities good for? Development. That's where people come together and brainstorm, essentially. That's where capitalism comes from. Africa never had any need for private property until about 50 years ago, because if you butted up against a neighbour and you had a dispute over land, well, one of you could just move on. You know, so these, that very the foundation, you know, Europe, on the other hand, has always been quite, or for the last several thousand years, has been very crowded. Small little countries with very defined borders and people constantly going over to war over who owns what. Well, in Lagos today, people still don't know who owns what, because that's Lagos, in time, as a comparison, only just happened. You know, property rights haven't caught up. That is happening now. There are a billion people in Africa. By the end of this century, there will be 3 billion, which means that, you know, 4 in 10 out of humanity will be Africans. And that is what's driving development. South Africa, actually, is the, having been the sort of continental leader, is now the drag on the continent, and that's entirely to do with a horribly corrupt government, which is almost impossible to distinguish from organised crime these days. But everywhere else, Kenya and Nigeria is thriving despite government. And that's about power moving away from government and to business. It's no longer about being the one and only leader of a country. Now there are plenty of rich people who have nothing to do with government. You know, power is diversifying and it's moving away from essentially a sort of a fairly feudal system into a much more, at least economically, democratic system. And it's that release that is powering Africa. And it's unstoppable, actually. So when you talk about countries moving away from, you know, a kind of aid or dependency or poverty paradigm, Africa's been doing that for 15 years. It's just that people haven't really noticed. But it has been doing it for 15 years, and there's no reason to believe why that won't continue. If Kenya, for instance, continues on the path that it is, Kenya, you know, average African country, average size, average population, it will be Singapore in 50 years' time. That's where the trajectory will take it. So, you know, a lot of these misperceptions will be, I think you'll see them falling away. One of the biggest ones, Africa, it's a lot of its biggest growth is coming from farming. So instead of feeding Africa, Africa is going to feed the world. And you may not see it in your newspapers, and you certainly won't see it in your aid campaigns, but you'll see it on the labels in your food. You know, these peas, this asparagus grown on Mount Kenya. You know, it's changing, but you've got to see it.
Before you wrap up, can we get you to talk a little bit about journalism and media and the challenges looking into the future? So you don't leave us much hope when you talk about this. And so the argument you were saying, at least in your first case, that you got this story quite easily, you suggested, right? There were no sort of structural resistance or issues of getting this story. The challenge for you was the apathy of the reception side. So, what is journalist to do? What is a media scholar to do where it doesn't matter?
That's a good question, actually. I mean, my response and most people's response in the field is just, you know, when you're banging your head against a wall, you know, our response has been reasonably unsophisticated. Just keep banging your head, you know. Occasionally, you know, you get some kind of success. But I'm looking at different media. I mean, I've been print for 25 years, and I find much more appetite for truthful, deeply reported narrative non-fiction in television and movies. Okay, you know, I love movies too. If that's the way it's got to be, there is still an appetite for misperception overthrowing deeply reported stuff in the States, you know, and after all, like, overthrowing people's misperception, I mean, that's journalism gold. I mean, that's what we live for, is confounding people. You know, what you think you know is not true. That's an exciting story. And there are, you know, maybe 10, 15 magazines in the States and, you know, a couple of newspapers that will still take that sort of stuff and still invest in it. And, you know, this stuff, it doesn't cost a fortune, but it costs money. The bad news is in the UK is that, I mean, that kind of stuff is just, it's dead. I mean, it's just, I've been pounding the streets for the last 4 or 5 months and it can't be done. It can't be done. I mean, Guardian long reads will tell you that they are the pinnacle of long-form journalism in the UK, but frankly, at 50p a word, they're the killer of long-form journalism in the UK. That stuff takes, you know, months and not, if not years to report. And at £2,000 a month, every 6 months, whatever, you know, I got three kids, I can't make it pay. It is bleak, but there are ways. You can, as long as you're nimble enough to new media, to things like grants, to and I, you know, I don't think it's gonna die. Just from a very personal point of view, it, you know, if we're talking about perceptions and definitions, well, you know, that kind of work is to a slightly uncomfortable degree how I define myself. You know, I can't really do anything else. It's what I dream, you know, it's what I wake up thinking. I've got the wiring in my brain. I've been doing it for 25 years and I don't want to do anything else. You know, and not having enough money doesn't seem to be an interesting reason, enough reason not to do it.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Alex. Slightly optimistic note. Keep banging your head. Thank you.